Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, Charlotte City Council wants to hit the pause button on a decision to elevate the new I-77 toll lanes. Cuts resulting from Donald Trump's big, beautiful bill are about to hit home. Mecklenburg County is bracing for trouble, or as Commissioner Vilma Leek put it,
"We're going to suffer."
Hundreds of young people descend on Brookdale Village, stopping traffic, jumping on cars. That leads to new restrictions there, while restrictions in NoDa make street vendors illegal. And that went into effect on Sunday to cut down on congestion. Not everyone is on board.
Having a couple extra street vendors around, I don't think makes the problem any worse.
Early voting in the primaries is underway. One candidate has his home shot at. We get a measles update, and Charlotte FC prepares for their first match of the season. And here to talk about all of those stories and more is WFAE senior editor Eli Portillo. He's here along with Mary Ramsey, the local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Ryan Pitkin is co-founder and editor of Queen City Nerve, and Eric Spanberg is the managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Morning, everybody. Welcome.
Good morning.
Let's begin with a story that was a story, good Lord, 36 years ago, and it's just now been solved. It came out late yesterday afternoon that a Charlotte murder case that's been cold for 36 years was finally, well, allegedly solved. Yesterday, CMPD announced the arrest of a suspect in the murder of Kim Thomas Friedland. It occurred in her home on July 27th, 1990. Police arrested Marion Gales yesterday. Eli, Marion Gales has been associated with this case since the very beginning. Wasn't he the handyman, a person of interest years ago?
Yes, and when I moved to Charlotte in 2009 to work as a crime reporter, actually, I was told about this case as one of the longest-running cold cases, and you know that was 17 years ago. It was a very brutal murder, and Marion Gales was one of two initial suspects, along with her husband, who was charged before those charges were dropped. There was not physical evidence at the time that they could process connecting him to the case. What police said is that new DNA technology and improved DNA analysis allowed them to go back and reanalyze some of that evidence and they say link Marion Gales to the killing, to the scene, and that is what resulted in these charges.
Gets a little sticky in there because there was a set of handcuffs that I think he confined her with during the murder, allegedly, and it matches a set of handcuffs that he evidently had in his possession at some point. The DNA evidence that came back, I think, on Tuesday and allowed police to make the arrest on Thursday was something that Dr. Friedland, her husband's attorney, pointed to several years ago, and police evidently did not pick up on it. Why?
You know, I'm not sure of all those twists. Okay. What the police said is that they did go back to evidence they already had, physical evidence, and reanalyze it using new DNA technology. There's been, you know, really seismic advances, not just since 1990, but in the last few years. And, you know, Marion Gales had previously been jailed on a separate homicide case for 20 years. So I think in some ways it was not surprising, this resolution, but still after 36 years, you know, the family might have some closure.
Police arrested him yesterday. They charged him with first-degree murder. As you say, he'd been in prison for 20 years. He just got out of prison in March of 2025. Meanwhile, Kim Friedland's husband, Dr. Edward Friedland, you've mentioned, had for a long time been considered a suspect. 4 years after her death, he was charged with the murder, and those charges were later dropped without prejudice, meaning that they could have come back and charged him with it. So has he been a suspect? The CMPD has said that they've been working this case for 30 years. So has he been a suspect all of that time and finally his name has been cleared?
I don't know that he was actively considered a suspect anymore after the charges were dropped. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that from a personal perspective, having someone else charged with what they say is definitive DNA evidence must be in some way a weight off that. But it's a really terrible case, especially because there was a young child involved, a 10-month-old baby who was in the house at the time of the killing. And it's a case that really gripped Charlotte. And I'm sure long-term listeners will remember that quite well.
I think people have to understand that in 1990, Charlotte was a very different place than it was, than it is today. And that murder was horrific, and it gripped us for weeks in the news. Ryan.
Oh, yeah, I was just going to say, I don't know if he was still a suspect in the law's eyes so much, but he was definitely still under suspicion. There were three of her close friends who wrote a book about her life, who I know to have been very suspicious of him, and to the point of being convinced that he was, that the husband was the killer. So I know that he will be relieved to be, if this is, does turn out to get a conviction or to be true, that he'll be relieved to be under from that weight.
Okay, so we're likely going to have more toll lanes on I-77 from uptown to the South Carolina line. Planners have been concerned about carving up the west side again because they had to carve it up when they put the original I-77 in. So they have proposed elevating the toll lanes over the existing lanes, and that plan now has met with resistance from some west side residents and an organization called Sustain Charlotte. And at a recent town hall meeting, City Council's Malcolm Graham got an earful from constituents. And this week, Charlotte City Council, a majority of council, asked NCDOT to hit the pause button. Will they be responsive to that request, Eli?
Well, this is a little complicated. I'm going to have to drop a little alphabet soup. The city council, six members, have said that they think the state should pause, that they should not build these elevated toll lanes right now, take a pause and figure out if there's another way. City council previously supported this plan on the Charlotte Regional Transportation Organization. That's a separate body that gives the go-ahead for big plans. What the CRTPO is saying now is that the request for qualifications is already out there. It's too late to pull back, even if we wanted to. Sorry. So they're saying this essential deadline has passed and, whoops, it's too late now. So it's a little unclear.
Evidently, they have changed their minds in the past on projects at this stage. And WFAE asked why it is too late, and they declined to provide an explanation. Is that still the case?
They declined to point to a law. They said, the law says it's too late, we can't go back. WFAE Steve Harrison said, hey, can you point me to that law? And they said, no. So we are waiting to see if City Council will formally vote and if the CRTPO would then vote to try to pull the project back. All that could happen, and the state might still say, well, we're not going to listen to that.
Yeah. And now County Commissioner Lee Altman also says she wants a clear answer to the question as to why they can't make changes at this stage of the game.
It really feels like a bait and switch, because the most important term that had the greatest impact on my community that I serve and that my Board of County Commissioners is answerable to was not revealed until 2 months after this body arguably lost authority.
She once supported the project, but she's angry that NCDOT did not share designs until after it issued a request for qualifications from contractors. There have been three options for these lanes: widen the highway through I-7 through uptown, push it west because you can't go east because that's where the city sits, to elevate these lanes or to bury them. And a lot of residents would like to have those lanes buried. Were all those, they've had a lot of town hall meetings, Eric, about this. Were all of those options explored in those meetings, or was it just we widen or we elevate?
It was really we widen or we elevate. Now, the neighborhood groups and Sustain Charlotte, the organization you mentioned, they have been pushing for what is known as capping of interstates, and then you put the lanes underneath. I guess the Big Dig in Boston is probably the most famous example, but it's happened in a lot of places, and it allows you to usually create green space or neighborhoods and other things like that. So the frustration here, Mike, is, as Eli said, it's all very tangled and complicated. But this discussion about toll lanes started 19 years ago, 2007. 2024, City Council unanimously says we want to support this through the other organization that Eli mentioned. But the two design options only came out in November. And then in February this month, the elevated design option was selected, and that's when people really got hot, and that's where we stand right now.
And I know you want to jump in on this, Eli, but the objections by neighborhood groups and by Sustain Charlotte to the elevation of these lanes is that it will create more noise through the uptown area because you have extra traffic. I don't know how that's any different than widening the highway, but nonetheless, they say it would create more noise, and it would be ugly because it would be tall and you could see it from their backyards. Eli.
Yeah, and I will say they hate the widening option even more because that would destroy more neighborhoods, including right. encroaching on historic cemeteries. They really want to see it buried. The state says that's too expensive. I think it's important to step back and look at the bigger picture, which is that for probably at least 5 years now, the city and state have been talking about how I-77 and other highways sliced through Black neighborhoods when they were built and cut them off from uptown. And there's been a big push to restore those connections. There's a study that the Knight Foundation has been involved in that they actually had a meeting on this week looking at how to cover up 77 and reconnect those, like the Big Dig that was mentioned. In some ways, I think a lot of people are feeling whiplash or betrayed because for years, public officials have been talking about how highway construction through neighborhoods was a big mistake. Yeah. We need to reverse it. We need to undo it. And now they're like, well, actually, let's build 60-foot high toll lanes.
I'm going to ask a question. I'm going to ask a question that can't be answered because this seems to be a repetitive thing where people feel betrayed after years of discussions and laying out what they want and they think they've been heard, and then the plan comes out and it's not anything like what they wanted. This is not the first time this has happened. Why?
I-77 North, anyone?
Why does it continue to happen?
I think because one reason is that there are so many cooks in the kitchen here. You have City Council, County Commission, Charlotte Regional Transportation Planning Organization, the State Department of Transportation, and the federal government. And they all have different methods of hearing them. So, you know, you can go speak at your county commission meeting. The county commissioners can say, wow, we really think we need to bury these lanes. But guess what? They don't make the decision. So there's a lot of cooks in the kitchen. There's a lot of input mechanisms, and it's not clear, especially to the public, who's making the decision and if their voice is really heard.
Eric.
I was just going to say one of the other things that complicates this too is that you're bringing in private operators to build and manage these projects, and they have to make their money back. And that means you paying the tolls. And as we all know, I-77 North, a lot of people were angry about and continue to be angry about those rates. And the higher that price goes, the higher those tolls go.
So six council members, Joy Mayo, Victoria Watlington, J.D. Mazzura, Arias, Kimberly Owens, Malcolm Graham, and Dimple Ajmera say they want the process to slow down. Ed Driggs wants it to move forward. Dimple wants it to move forward, but she says it's important to move forward responsibly. I have 20 seconds. What does that mean?
I think it means that politics are at play here, and when you see a backlash like that building, you can't just say, well, let's keep moving without any changes. So they're trying to recalibrate and figure out what to do.
So this is an issue we'll be talking about till 2037. So we have plenty of time to investigate this. When we come back, we'll talk about some budget issues at the county and the transit business program, which has met some pushback. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the weekly news roundup with Eli Portillo being here. He's our senior editor at WFAE News. Eric Spanberg is the managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Ryan Pitkin is the co-founder and editor of Queen City Nerve. And Mary Ramsey is with us. She's the local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. And Mary, the Mecklenburg County Commission is warning of a looming crisis resulting from the big, beautiful bill, Donald Trump's big bill that passed last year. How so?
So this latest update has to do with funding for Medicaid and food assistance programs that the county is involved in. County commissioners heard an update on federal impacts to that. And two of the big points of emphasis were that the additional work requirements for folks who are getting assistance is going to mean a lot of extra work for the county. And that means taking longer for people to get their applications processed, higher risk of mistakes getting made by staff as they try to deal with a higher volume of applications. The county is also going to be losing money, about $7.5 million they estimated in fiscal year 2027 and $10 million the following year from the federal government. This is because the Fed is going to be reimbursing at a lower rate for some food assistance programs that the county is involved in. And all of this has the potential to create quite the budget headache for Mecklenburg in the coming years.
So it's a double whammy. It has to do with benefits to a certain degree, but it also has to do with reimbursement for clerical things that have to take place at the county level to keep track, I guess, of where the money goes. And Lonnie Parker, who is Mecklenburg County's business operations director, pointed out that's going to be a problem.
This will cause additional work for our staff, especially in the coming fiscal year. As participants are denied, they will reapply in 30 days.
So constant churn for the staff trying to keep up with all of this. What was the reaction of the commission to these dire predictions?
Yeah, well, you used the word that they used, saying that this could potentially be a crisis for the county. They expressed a lot of frustration with the fact that they've gotten little to no word from the state about what the state may or may not do to help out with this situation, noting that North Carolina still does not have a budget. The fact that having to deal with all this is going to put a lot of drain on the county's ability to invest in its other priorities. And just expressing a lot of frustration with the Trump administration for these policies. The county commission is all Democrats, so not really going to see anybody on that body sticking up for the Trump administration right. and their policies and this landmark bill.
I know you want to chime in here, Eli, but George Dunlap on the commission cautions that these cuts may make further property tax increases unavoidable. That's something that Laura Meyer called a crisis because we can't keep taxing people, she says. Meanwhile, Commissioner Vilma Leek says the county will need to shift some money around to make up for shortfalls.
The budget that we work on will make some sacrifices with other agencies that we can make some decisions that will impact the lives of our people, because we're going to suffer. There's no buts and ands about it.
So when this bill was being debated in Washington, did local officials understand? Did state officials understand? Did D.C. officials understand the implications of what was likely to happen to the social safety net and how it was administered, Eli?
I think so. I think I remember hearing a lot of concern from local and state leaders about the impact of programs like SNAP, like Medicaid. And, you know, one dynamic of this is it is could kind of function as a backdoor way of cutting those programs. For example, the federal government doesn't have to say we're going to slash the funding this much. But if you make it harder to apply, you have to recertify every 6 months instead of every year. You have to meet work requirements that have to be documented, et cetera. And at the same time, you're reducing the amount of administrative funding. It gums the whole system up. It means fewer people will be on those benefit rolls. And you can, you know, cut those programs, cut the number of people receiving those benefits without standing up in Congress and saying, we're going to cut food stamps by 40%. Yeah. So that's one thing. The other thing, you mentioned property taxes and Dunlap's comment on that. The State General Assembly just had a meeting this week of a new committee that is looking at state property, state-imposed tax caps for property taxes. So at the same time, governments like Mecklenburg County are worrying about raising more money and having to raise property taxes. The state is gearing up to limit their ability to do so because they say property taxes are out of control. So Mecklenburg County is really facing a crunch from two directions over the next few years here.
So hidden agendas may be at play here, at least in Washington. And Mary, let me turn to you as the local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. The Trump administration and Republicans have been looking at waste, fraud, and abuse. They've been combing through the records in Washington, D.C., and tossing things out left and right. Has anyone, and of course they did find waste, fraud, and abuse in these programs in Minnesota, has anyone run an audit here of where the money we get from the federal government for SNAP goes in Mecklenburg? And if we did run that audit, might we find enough waste, fraud, and or abuse that could make up for the difference in funding?
That's a good question. I'm not sure off the top of my head when the last audit of that specific chunk of programming was done. I will say, you know, you talked about the additional administrative requirements and the fact that the county could be losing some administrative money. I think one of the things county staff has been emphasizing is that that could lead to more mistakes, which could then end up costing the county, because the county does get fined when things don't go right. If an application is not approved within the required time frame, if it's approved or unapproved for the wrong reasons, these are things that the county can be dinged for, and that can cost additional money. And the county staff is worrying that this higher volume of churn, the fact that they're having to do more work, could lead inadvertently to more mistakes.
Meanwhile, Mecklenburg County Commissioners also discussed plans this week for a new program to help small businesses likely displaced by future transit construction. Ryan, would this be along the new train routes or for other transit projects that have come from this transit tax as well? Unmute yourself, Ryan.
Sorry. Yes, I believe it would be along really anything that's affected, anything that comes about development due to this new transit tax. You know, there's a lot of pools that have been discussed to death here on the show and elsewhere about 40% goes to this and 60% to that and this and that. But none of it was really put aside for the way it will affect folks. We saw when the Gold Line was first built into Elizabeth, that was one of the ones that was headlines for years, where businesses were forced to close. They'd lost all their foot traffic. And it's already literally happening now. I wrote last week about Block Love Charlotte has seen a 300% rent increase already on their building along in near DeRida on Graham Street. And they're going to have to move out of their building. And it's because of the Red Line. They're right along that train track. So yeah, Someone has to step up and look out for these folks who are going to be facing huge rent increases and fees.
Eric.
Well, Mike, you must be talking about Project BOAST, which of course we know is Business Opportunity and Supportive Transit. We all love a good acronym. Ryan's absolutely right. I was going to mention also that another piece of this is trying to help small businesses be prepared to bid on and secure contracts for various parts of the work. Remember, they're going to spend, $17.5 billion on transit alone, and then $7.8 billion, I guess, on roads. But one of the interesting things about that is trying to figure out how to show small businesses how to do the accounting, how to do the bidding, how to be prepared to do this kind of work. And now we have the county, the city, and the Charlotte Regional Business Alliance are all working on programs. They say they're talking to one another, but this is going to get sort of crowded and jumbled very quickly. So I think people are going to have to keep a close eye on this to make sure it all works.
So county staff has proposed offering lines of credit. They're not free. Expanding access to contracting opportunities, as you just mentioned, and providing other assistance to businesses affected by any new transit lines. But some commissioners are skeptical, among them Susan Rodriguez McDowell.
I think you all have designed a great program, but why is it the county's to do?
So let me turn that around. If not the county, who?
Mary?
Point of emphasis in that discussion, the point that Commissioner Rodriguez McDowell and some other commissioners made, was that the county, compared to the city of Charlotte, the towns, really not getting a ton of money out of this new sales tax. And so sort of questioning why the county is being charged with picking up the bill for this, especially given, as we were just talking about, the county is likely to face some pretty tight budget windows in the coming fiscal year. So a lot of commissioners saying, you know, this is a really good idea in theory, but, you know, the Business Alliance was the one that really pushed this referendum. The corporate community really pushed this referendum. The city of Charlotte and the towns are the ones that are going to be getting some of the sales tax money coming in. So maybe they should be the ones footing the bill for this kind of programming. So
what kind of money are we talking about here?
Well, that's what I wanted to mention, Mike. That's the funny part. So at full strength, this program is $3 million a year, and the county's budget was $2.54 billion, or is $2.54 billion right now. So, and Mary, all those points that you're making are absolutely valid, but whoever pays for it, this is sofa money compared to everything else that's going on. This one shouldn't be much of a fight.
We seem to have a lot of sofa money floating around, however, and that adds up over time. Last weekend, there was a significant disturbance at Birkdale Village, which has provoked concern among both residents and business owners there. That is the sound of the disturbance heard from a second-story overlook as posted on TikTok. Eli, what happened?
So there were around 100-plus teenagers who the Birkdale management and Huntersville police say Ubered in or drove in from surrounding areas and did sort of a flash mob, you know, dancing in the streets, some people dancing on cars, dancing on occupied cars that people were trying to drive through Birkdale. I've seen, you know, you can see the videos online. I've seen them. And one thing that struck me is in this giant crowd, every single person, with just one or two exceptions, has a phone, and everyone is filming themselves and the crowd. So the Birkdale has...
So is this the new version what did teenagers used to do? They used to go down the street in a line with their cars.
Cruising.
What was that called?
Yeah.
Cruising. Is this the new version of cruising?
Maybe. I mean, I'm almost 40, so don't ask me. But, you know, I think... It is.
Were you there, Eli? Were you there?
You know, if I were there, I would have been one of the people in the car horrified as it was being danced on. Yeah. So Birkdale, you know, has really had a reputation historically, I think, as an upscale shopping center. And, you know, teens dancing on car roofs at 8 p.m. is really, really not the image they want.
Yeah. It's not a good look. And if you look at that TikTok video, you would think that a mob, and maybe it is true that a mob essentially descended on this multi-use center, hundreds of young people involved. And WCNC-TV spoke with a man named Jordan Miller, who happened to be having dinner there at the time.
We noticed like 200 to 300 kids, like kind of in the street, everywhere, running around, running in front of cars, actually even jumping on some cars. So what they would do is they would run in front of cars as they're driving through, make them stop. And if they would not stop, they would start kind of like running on top of them.
So was this organized? Was this organic? Did this come together on social media? Why did they choose Birkdale? Do we know who these kids were, et cetera?
I mean, I think it came together on social media. I don't know why Birkdale, but I think, you know, many of us have done stupid things as teens, so I have some sympathy there. But the older I get, the more I find myself sympathizing with the supposed bad guys in Footloose who wanted to band dancing. You know, so
kids these days.
Yes, I find the older I get, the more I shake my fist at kids these days. And I do have to say, I understand it would be pretty scary if you're just driving, trying to get to a park at a restaurant in Birkdale and people stop your car and start running on the hood.
So residents and
really
business
trying to stop that.
Residents and business owners packed a town hall meeting this week about this, and they described what happened as chaotic and unacceptable. I think any adult would agree with that. So what has Birkdale Village decided to do?
They've imposed a 6 p.m. curfew on unaccompanied minors. That's moving it up 2 hours from where it was before. They've also started working with Huntersville Police more, and they say Huntersville Police says they will be increasing their presence there and patrolling more.
Okay. And new restrictions went into effect on Sunday in NoDa. Charlotte had been running a pilot street market program in that area, which allowed street vendors to be in place. That ended on Sunday, so street vending there is now illegal. What was the purpose, Ryan, of the pilot program?
There had been growing concerns from business owners in the area around the presence of street vendors. It's been an up and down thing in NoDa for decades. And it really reached ahead in 2023 when there were a few violent incidents, not necessarily involving people who were working as street vendors, but people who were sort of milling about with said street vendors. And there was a shooting when there was a fight between two folks that spilled into a local business. So it really had local business owners sort of speaking out. Some didn't like the fact that they had to compete with these folks who didn't have to pay rent or licensing or anything like that, any fees. And the pilot program was set in place last fall to sort of bring some order to it, make folks apply, give them a spot where they were allowed to be. They knew who was going to be there. There was no food. You couldn't sell food products or CBD or things that were consumable. And it sort of was supposed to give some order to what was happening in NoDa. And that's what's run for the last 6 months.
Outside of Uptown and NoDa, street vending is largely unregulated, but in those areas, they're classified as congested, so it's not usually legal. One business owner did tell WCNC-TV that they want the vendors in the neighborhood because they bring in people and they generate traffic, and the station spoke with Brandon Richardson, who lives in NoDa, walks the area often, and says street vendors do not pose any kind of problem.
No, not at all. And getting around people, it's never been a problem. I mean, even just the sidewalks the way they are now, if a business opens a door, you're having to move around it. So having a couple extra street vendors around, I don't think makes the problem any worse, really.
So this was a pilot program. It ended Sunday. Is the newly formed safety committee likely to recommend allowing vendors in NoDa? In other words, could it come back after they study the results of the pilot program?
It didn't sound like it in the committee meeting that took place in, I believe it was late January, when they recommended that they just sort of let this expire. This didn't have to come back in front of the full council for a vote. It was a 6-month program. If they took no action, then it expired on Sunday. And there was a lot of sort of disconnect. There was a hearing this Tuesday where street vendors were allowed to come and do a public forum in front of council. It was very disconnected from what was told to the committee, which city staff was saying that they have no knowledge of any street vendors who were unable to apply or had problems with applications. I've spoken to street vendors who did have problems. Street vendors spoke on Tuesday who did. So there's been a big disconnect there.
When we come back, we'll talk about the possible resurrection of Jail North, GOP party switchers, and a gunshot into a candidate running for Mecklenburg, into the home of a candidate running for Mecklenburg County Commission. It's Charlotte Talks. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. Eli Portillo is with us, WFAE News senior editor. Ryan Pitkin is co-founder and editor of Queen City Nerve. Eric Spanberg is managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. And Mary Ramsey is local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. The closing of Jail North, that was Mecklenburg County's juvenile detention center, has been of concern since Sheriff Gary McFadden made that decision to close it in 2022. But now it appears the reopening of that facility is up for discussion. Eli, why now?
Well, there are a few reasons. One is that after a few years, we've seen the effects of juveniles who are detained being sent to other counties, some of them hours away. And that is obviously bad for their ability to stay in touch with their families, receive legal representation. The sheriff's office also has to go drive hours to get them and drive them hours back for every court hearing and check-in. The other, I think, is politics. It is, about 2 weeks out from an election right now. The primary election will determine who is the next Mecklenburg County Sheriff, since there are no Republicans in the race. And this is a big campaign issue. Ricky Robbins, one of the challengers who has racked up a lot of endorsements, wants to reopen Jail North. Kevin Collins, another challenger, has said he does not support reopening Jail North because it's not the sheriff's responsibility. So for McFadden to come out and say, I'm going to push to reopen this and here's how we'll do it, sets up a campaign issue that differentiates him from a couple of his surging opponents.
The reopening of this facility is said to cost about $17 million, and then there's the $15 million a year operating cost that have been talked about. Is that extra money in the yet-to-be-passed state budget?
Well, no. And, you know, that's one of several complications. One, I don't know how you'd pay for it. The state is not showering money on Mecklenburg County and is, as you said, about 7 months behind passing its budget right now. The other is logistically, you would need 98 personnel to reopen this. And Sheriff McFadden has previously said that it is not possible to recruit and staff all those personnel. And that's why he closed it a couple years ago. So that's another big hurdle that I haven't seen how we'd resolve.
And at a press conference this week, Sheriff McFadden explained that hiring that many workers, 98, in an environment that currently depicts law enforcement in a negative light would be difficult.
People would rather go and work somewhere else than working law enforcement. Then we have to compete against CMPD and all the other townships to hire the 98 people.
Is law enforcement being seen in a negative light?
Well, I certainly think if you look at the last few years, post George Floyd, defund the police movement, that's all what McFadden is pointing to. Mm-hmm. He's also pointing to criticism of the sheriff's office and the jail, where people, including his opponents in this primary, have pointed out how about 24 people have died in the jail in recent years, and there have been tons of problems there with you know, the jail getting sued, et cetera. So he's also kind of, one, pointing to the national environment, and two, saying everyone's criticizing me and the jail, and that's making it hard for me to recruit people. Whether that's fair or not, I think that's for voters to decide.
Ryan.
It would appear to me, what I find interesting in the story that hasn't been mentioned by McFadden or anyone, is that it was one of his actual bright spots in PR is how he ran his juvenile facilities. He ended solitary confinement for juveniles before it became a thing that was statewide. He was running a lot of really positive programs out of there. And it just seems like if anyone would want that back, you know, it would be him. And there's plenty of opportunities to hire non-law enforcement, non-sworn personnel on top of obviously some of the folks who need to enforce the rules there and keep order. So it doesn't have to necessarily be 98 cops that are in there.
Right.
I think that he has certain opinions that he's trying to express there in the broader aspect, but he was really doing that compared to how he runs the jail, how he was running the juvenile facility was really a positive for him in terms of as an elected official.
So, Mary, the primary elections obviously are underway. Early voting is going on through February 28th. Election day is March 3rd. And there are a couple of party switchers running in Republican races. Kelly Van Horn and Kate Barr recently switched parties to run as Republicans. And you report that maybe not the state GOP, but county GOPs are shunning them. How?
Yes, so the Mecklenburg County Republican Party passed a resolution disavowing any support for Van Horn, saying she would not get a party endorsement, she would not be allowed to utilize party resources. The Republican Party's 14th Congressional District chapter, which is where Kate Barr is running, passed a nearly identical resolution. And the state GOP has also put out a statement disavowing Van Horn and five other candidates she's running with. They call themselves NC Educators on the Ballot. They are a group of teachers who are running in Republican primaries, saying their focus is on bringing that educator experience into the discussion around school funding in North Carolina. Whereas Kate Barr ran against Vicki Sawyer in 2024 with the campaign message that got a lot of national attention that she couldn't win because of gerrymandering. She has been very open about the fact that she has changed party in name only to run against him more, again, to make a point about gerrymandering.
Yeah, and I think Van Horn has said that she's running because it's the only way to get that point of view across in a Republican-controlled state. But the state GOP has called her a counterfeit candidate. She's running against Tricia Cottom. Speaking of counterfeit, she was elected a couple of years ago as a Democrat and then quickly changed to a Republican in office, and that gave the Republicans a temporary supermajority. These women have switched to run, but is it a ruse? Are they wolves in sheep's clothing, or have they simply found that they identify more with the GOP, except on this one education issue?
think it depends on who you ask. I think if you ask the County Republican Party, they say, again, the phrase they've been using that you just quoted is counterfeit candidates. I've interviewed Kelly Van Horn. She told me that she feels like she would have had space in the Republican Party to sort of make her points in a statement on these resolutions. She told me that she feels like she and the candidates she's running with have been shut out of Republican Party discussions. They just wanted a seat at the table.
Is this an appropriate response to constant GOP gerrymandering? Is this the only way to have an impact if you don't agree with everything the GOP has to say? I mean, if you're going to gerrymander people out of districts, is this the only way to get that point across?
I think that's what these candidates are feeling. I think
they're
saying.
And is it a valid way? Is it a democratic way to do it?
I think it depends on who you ask. I think, you know, that's the argument these candidates are making. These parties are coming back. They're passing these resolutions saying at the end of the day, like, if you are not a part of our party, you are not going to be the voice of our party, and that you can't use our party and our party's primary process to make a political point. So it's one of the situations where it really depends on who you ask. Obviously, the issue of gerrymandering is one that's gone on for a long time here in North Carolina, not something that's likely to be resolved anytime soon. So, and a growing trend in North Carolina, I believe my colleagues at the News and Observer reported there's over 100 candidates on ballots across North Carolina this election cycle who have switched their party affiliation in the recent past.
Eli.
I just think this is one of those issues that generates a lot of noise, but not really that much impact. I mean, you know, these quote unquote counterfeit candidates, they are not going to win. And, you know, if you look at South Carolina, you've got an effort there to close primaries. They have open primaries like North Carolina, and the Republicans in the legislature, many of them want to move to a closed primary system because they say they're worried about Democrats or independents, you know, flooding into their primaries to get candidates who don't align with the Republicans elected. And I mean, I don't see that happening in South Carolina. It's not becoming some kind of, you know, secret liberal bastion. So
let's talk about here because we have these open primaries in North Carolina where independents can choose which primary to vote in. And if you have gerrymandered districts in which Republicans are set up to win no matter what happens, except in the primaries, if independents see these candidates as viable alternatives and agree with what they have to say, could they cause an upset in these elections?
I don't think it's very likely, given who turns out in primaries. It would take such a massive influx of independents who don't typically turn out that it seems extremely unlikely, especially against established candidates like Tim Moore.
Okay. Since the dawn of the Trump era, office holders and candidates for those offices have been facing threats, usually anonymous. Some have been killed. This week, a candidate for Mecklenburg County Commission had shots fired into his Huntersville home. Mary, what's the story here?
Yes, so this happened at the home of Aaron Marin. Aaron is running as a Republican for County Commission District 1, which includes parts of North Charlotte and the Lake Norman area towns. He ran in 2024 against incumbent Elaine Powell and lost. The seat is now open because Powell is retiring, and he'll face the winner of a three-person Democratic primary in the November general election. Huntersville police came out yesterday with an updated statement saying they believe the home was targeted. They also said they've involved the FBI in this investigation. So no suspects taken into custody as of yet, as far as I know, but certainly a situation that struck a lot of fear for Mr. Marin and his family. I believe he said that his wife and children were at the home at the time of the incident, although no one was injured. And he also said that he does feel like he was targeted, but wasn't going to speculate on the politics of it all, and said that he would continue to campaign for public office.
That was my next question. He may have been targeted, but do we know if it was a political targeting?
Huntersville police have said they do feel that the home was targeted. They have not gone so far as attributing it to anything specifically politically motivated. And so far as I know, the latest release I saw yesterday have not announced the name or names of any suspects.
So everybody wants to be first when it comes to presidential primaries. The Iowa caucuses are usually first. The state of New Hampshire usually has the honor of holding the first primary. But as we know, in the Joe Biden era, the Democratic Party allowed South Carolina to move up as a way of saying thank you for Joe Biden's victory in 2020. And now North Carolina wants to go first in 2028. Eric, how are Democrats here making the case?
We have better weather. No, they are. I'm just kidding, but we do have better weather. They are trying to make the case that North Carolina is reflective of, you know, the nation at large. It's a competitive state. It's a purple state, as we always hear over and over, and that it makes sense to start here. And of course, there are advantages for the state because you bring in more attention. You likely bring in a lot more national money that filters down to local and state races. So that is the case they're making. There's just one hiccup here, Mike. Do you know what that hiccup is?
The state legislature.
Yeah. State legislature makes that decision on the calendar. And in case you've been napping, the state legislature has a Republican majority, a clear Republican majority. And it seems unlikely that the Republican lawmakers would want to lend a hand to Anderson Clayton and the North Carolina Democratic Party.
Okay, so the Environmental Protection Agency is suddenly powerless, suddenly, all of a sudden, yesterday, powerless to regulate greenhouse gases. EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin was in Huntersville at a car dealership last Friday, calling this, quote, the largest act of deregulation in the history of the United States. Why was he in Huntersville, Eli?
You know, I wasn't totally clear on that. Maybe, like Eric was saying, better weather. But he was at the car dealership because he was speaking specifically in the context of getting rid of that start-stop feature that a lot of people don't like.
Of course, we all know that because scientists all agree that greenhouse gases have led to climate change, and there are areas of our state that have been feeling the brunt of that. We've seen tons of houses falling into the ocean because of higher surf, which is due to sea rise. We've seen the destruction wreaked by Hurricane Helene in the western part of our state. They're still recovering from that. EPA head Lee Zeldin referred to that part of the state, even as he explained his support for deregulation.
It is very important to us at the EPA to help them rebuild. But what I'm not going to do is grant myself new powers that are not authorized in federal statute to take actions that amount to trillions of dollars of new regulation.
So we have 2 minutes left. Help me understand this. He and the Trump administration are saying that the Environmental Protection Agency is not authorized to protect the environment.
They are not authorized to regulate greenhouse gases under a previous interpretation of the law. That's what they're saying.
Okay, but the greenhouse gases would allow, not doing that, would allow car manufacturers to remove mileage restrictions and exhaust regulations that would increase carbon dioxide levels and methane levels. Those are known pollutants, so why wouldn't they be able to regulate known pollutants?
I believe my understanding is that the finding is that those pollutants don't endanger human health in the way that other pollutants, you know, gases that, you know, can kill you right away, for example, that the EPA regulates do.
We are living in the book, 1984. So the Charlotte Hornets star LaMelo Ball was in a car accident at Trade and Tryon. What happened, Eric?
Yeah, we don't know if, because we haven't seen a police report, we don't know if this fits the definition of a basketball lane violation, but LaMelo Ball did collide with a car coming the other direction. No one was hurt. A tire did come off of LaMelo Ball's Hummer, according to videos that have been posted. He played last night, did all right, 11 points, 7 rebounds and 7 assists, but the Hornets lost. So it looks like things will go on, but we don't know who's at fault yet.
We don't know who's at fault. And the other car was a Nissan. I shudder to think if the Hummer lost a wheel, I shudder to think what happened to the Nissan. Speaking of soccer, Charlotte FC plays its first game of the new season tomorrow. They're bringing a new kit with them, new clothes, something that the soccer league does every couple of years. They change the uniforms. They're playing in St. Louis. St. Louis is known to win their opening games. What's the line on this? I have 5 seconds. What's the line?
I don't know the line, but let's just say new kit, victory. Why not?
Okay, why not? Eric Spanberg, managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Ryan Pitkin, co-founder and editor of Queen City Nerve. Mary Ramsey, the local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. And Eli Portillo with WFAE News. Thank you all.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.